When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Forever Dog.
Comic books, comic time. Writers and artists are on the line. They make a splash as a comic's read and take us on a trip behind the spread. Watch out for comic book commentary. Spinning a winning inside fix, how they got a hot idea. Narrative, character, visual tricks, and bam, onomatopoeia. Uh-huh. It's comic book commentary.
This first page was hard for me. I hope it looks effortless, but like, I think I did about four versions of it.
Wow, really?
I settled on this. Yeah.
I love talking to you and Mirka about how you do what you do. And I said, like, let's get it. Or I think you suggested, let's get a baseline and just sort of tell about our processes. And you sent me this stuff on how you work. And yeah, I don't understand any of it.
That's okay.
Like, it's, this is so far magic outside. It's just like, I don't know the visual arts. Like, I don't know how you do it. So can you sort of just walk me through the basics of what happens when you receive an issue from Mirka?
Yeah. Okay. So let's start. I'm going to start really, really basic, and then we can get into some like art stuff. So I'm going to start with really technical stuff. When I get the line art, that usually comes from the company, and it's usually put to a standard size, and then it has it's adjusted for the bleed and the crop and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes when people are independently creating things, they don't have that production experience, and so if I'm working with somebody with less production experience or independently, you know, production arm, then usually I have to do the production first.
Mm-hmm.
When I was starting out, I used to flat my own stuff. And sometimes for like really simple stuff, I'll still flat it. And this is preparing the line art in a way that I can easily select areas and color them.
I see.
So if you imagine the line art as like an acetate overlay, and then the flats would be like stencils, mm-hmm, that sort of cut out the area. So when I go in with a paintbrush, everything's all masked off. Okay?
That makes sense.
Yeah. And then you want like that line art on a layer above, so it's never disturbed by anything.
Mm-hmm.
So when I get the line art, if I don't have to do production, I send it right to the flatters. So these are people that I subcontract to who saved my life by flatting like 5 to 8 pages a day.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they're done with those, I get them back and then I color correct them. Because like I said, their job is not to pick colors. Their job is just to create selections. So sometimes in crowd scenes, I'll cheat a little and work off of their colors a little bit, but usually it has to be adjusted a lot to get what I'm specifically looking for.
Because interesting.
Color has mood, right? Mm-hmm. And you can't just throw everything together and expect a mood to be created. So you have to sort of control all that stuff. And there's various techniques to control it. And how a colorist does that is kind of how the colorist develops their own style.
Okay. And we can talk a little bit about that, especially on these first few pages of issue 2. But I'm curious to know, like, what do you see as your job? I mean, if it strikes me that there's so much, it's mood, and then technically it's not just color, it's light and shadow and that kind of thing, which isn't always part of the line art. What all goes on in your head as you're looking at, for example, like this first page, this splash page?
So I sort of think of coloring as the soundtrack to a movie.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is not necessary, but it helps a lot. It helps direct your attention. It helps inform your feelings. It helps create focus. So for me, I prioritize coloring. The first thing that's most important is that I should create focus. Mm-hmm. The second thing that's most important is I should create mood. And then sort of whatever after that.
whatever
needs to be done.
So let's talk about those things. In creating focus, what does that mean? How do you decide what needs
this
focus?
This is one of my favorite things to talk about. This is actually like a really technical art thing that applies to any form of art. Creating focus in visual arts, you have a lot of tools at your disposal. The first one that's most obvious is contrast, okay? So where you put the highest points of contrast is where the human eye is naturally going to go to immediately. So where you have a really strong highlight next to a really deep shadow, that's like your strongest point of contrast. Mm-hmm. Another thing you can use to create focus is you can use detail. So how much detail there is also sort of causes the eye to look at it and tarry there. For me, I have a really strong attraction to diagonal. So I tend to use those a lot. I like them. Where there's a visual tension, so where curves intersect with hard lines.
Interesting.
Will cause focus.
Will you point that out as we go through? I'd be curious to sort of get specific examples of that stuff.
I don't know if I use that much in here. Oh, there's a few spots where it occurs.
Okay. As it strikes.
And another thing you can use is you can use warm cold contrast. So a color can be warm or it can be cold, and you can create a lot of interest when you put those two together.
Sure. Oh, that's interesting. And then, so that's the sort of starting point, right? Like is creating focus. And then tell me again, what was the next thing you said? The next
mood.
Step for you?
Yeah. Mood.
Yeah.
So for mood, I went to school for painting.
Okay.
So I have a background in fine arts, oil painting. I did like lots of gouache painting and oil painting in my 20s. And so all that sort of built up data of feelings in my head that I associate with different colors.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a little something I'm doing in Hexwives, which is like, I think a lot of people in comics have a contrarian streak, and I am definitely one of those, because I have this thing where like people are like, oh, well, all these colors specifically mean this one thing, right? Like red means angry. It doesn't. Like the color has no inherent meaning that's not given to it contextually or culturally, right? So what I have been doing, and I'm hoping people pick up on this, but maybe they don't, I don't know. I could be more heavy-handed with it. And I think we've talked about me getting more heavy-handed with it, but
I don't know that this book needs anything more heavy-handed in it.
I'm using the color green to be the colors of control. And I specifically chose that color, one, because it's not really used that way very much, so it should give it a little bit of uncanny feeling, because people would normally associate like red with control, right?
Sure.
But I didn't want to do that. I wanted the blood to stand out. Green has a wider range of values, so red has a really neat narrow range of values. So if I associated the architects with red, I wouldn't be able to have them in lots of different locations. I wouldn't be able to slowly seep it into the page because it has such a limited value range and such a limited temperature range. Whereas green has, you have warm greens, you have cold greens, you have, you have the whole value range with green. So I can start seeping it in everywhere. And the human eye is very sensitive to that color. So, That's why I chose green. And it sets off the blood magic nicely.
Yeah, that's so really interesting. I remember, well, two things. There was the panel at the end of issue two, which was a, I think it was just a one-er of Aaron. And yeah, it was a panel that to me, when I was writing it, I felt like it was very innocuous. Like the subtext was going to do all the work. And then when I got the color to it, it was this angry green. And it should, like, that shouldn't work, but it worked so well. And it heightened the tension of that scene incredibly well. And instead of asking the reader to understand the subtext and then apply it to the tension of the scene, you were giving it to him in such a visceral way. It really knocked me out.
Well, thank you. And I'm lucky because like I think I'm maybe a little naturally sensitive to color. And part of why I went into painting was just like I love color. I love putting colors next to each other and seeing what happens and how it makes me feel and how other people react to it. Like when I was tweeting about those greens a while ago, like people had really visceral reactions to that green.
Can you, and I was like, let's talk about, for people who didn't see it, will you talk about that for a second? And I'm curious to hear what people's reactions were and why you think they were that.
I don't know why it happened. I just know that it does happen. So I tweeted out like this really weird green palette that I like. That's like, it's a very cold sort of yellowy green, mm-hmm. and then a really warm sort of olive green that's a little less saturated. And then there was like a saturated, cold, dark green also. But it's just like a palette of greens that I mm-hmm. really like that a lot of people have a very visceral reaction to. And it was just like one of those things where people were like, this is disgusting. Like half the people were like, this is disgusting. And half the people were like, I love this. I have no idea why that happens, but for some reason that set of greens like really makes people have feelings.
What is your reaction to it? Like, what does it evoke for you and how would you want to use it?
For me, and maybe this is what people's reacting to, because mm-hmm. I guess you wouldn't ever really see those greens together in a natural setting. So like on a really, primitive level, we're mm-hmm. like, whoa, something's uncanny here.
Yeah.
And for me, anytime anything's uncanny, like I run towards it. I'm like, what's this? What's going on over here? How do I take this apart? And maybe that's not everybody's reaction.
That's so interesting. I don't know when you posted that and we should put it back up when we put this out. But like to me, it felt like, oh, you could do a whole Swamp Thing run in this palette. You know what I mean? Like yes. It has the organic plus, unnatural,
yes.
Or the organic plus almost supernatural that a book like that would have.
Yeah, I would love to work on a Swamp Thing.
What are we waiting for?
What?
What are we waiting for? DC,
somebody has to hire me.
If you're listening. Sure they are. let's talk about this issue three for a moment. Mirka started it with this splash page, which is a close-up of Izzy, which I don't think this was in my script. I think... I tend to do a wider shot on a splash page, and this was Mirka's decision. I think it's such a good one.
Yeah, I love it.
Tell me a little bit about the lighting on this page.
Okay, this one was like tough, like I said before, just because one of the other things I'm doing in this book is I want to set up that tension between the real world and the false world.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to do like a corny shifted palette thing. Because, well, one, I needed that shifted palette for the control.
What does shifted palette mean?
It's just like putting, if you think of a palette as like five sets of colors,
mm-hmm.
right? You can scoot them all over a little bit on the color wheel mm-hmm. in relationship to each other so that you can tell it's different, but it still has a relationship to the pre-palette. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm using specific palettes for like control and magic and things like that. So I couldn't really do the real world versus the fake world by moving around palettes, because I think that would get things too visually muddy.
Mm-hmm.
So what I decided to do was do like cell cut versus more rendered. So cell cut is like, like it looks when they're in the fake world and there's just one hard shadow. Okay.
I see. Yeah.
And then on the other ones, like I'll do like gradients and I'll do like more lighting sources and things like that.
Oh, neat.
So it should give this like, that should also build a little bit on the uncanniness.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes like it doesn't always work, but you know, you try. Sometimes you fail. Sometimes
yeah,
it works.
No, I mean, looking at this, it's like, it's a horror movie shot. Right?
Yeah.
It's all mood, and what you've put in here not just enhances what the line art was, but it feels like it tells more of the story, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So on this one, the first thing I had to do was like, I had to look at the pages together and figure out how the three things I was working with fit together.
Mm-hmm.
How the palettes and the lighting work together. And that's what made this first shot really hard because I have to, she's sort of caught in between that false world and the real world right now.
Yeah.
But, it took me a few tries to convey that. Because if I rendered it up a lot, in the light areas, then it looked a little like corny.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't really have that strength of light blasting her in the face. And I tried lighting it different ways, like with a angled light. I lit directly from the bottom up. I lit her face from a couple different directions,
wow.
But this was the one splitting it in half was the one that evoked the best feeling for me.
Yeah.
And well, I had to figure out how to get that, like, the light to show that there's more complex lighting in here.
Yeah, that was the thing I was really curious about. Because when you look at these next couple pages and we're in this hidden room, there is no real light source. I mean, I guess there's that candle, right?
Yeah.
But that's kind of it. So,
yeah.
You know, you get on like on pages 2 and 3, like there's this, it's not a flat light, but it's a light that's not from anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah, that's called a sculptural light.
Okay.
So you can... Oh, sorry about that. Oh, we got some mail. Esther, one second.
Is your mailman a dog? I say we leave that in.
She's helping me out. She wants that's me to nice. Know there's mail. yeah, so this is what's called sculptural light. And so what I wanted to do in here is, you see I built up to that green. I'm sort of going to treat this all as one sequence because
yeah,
that's
sure.
the way I think about things. So I knew at the end of the sequence, they needed green light cast on them. And that the green light needed to like flatten out at the end as she goes more under his control.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, okay, if I need that light cast, what I can do is use like a sculptural light. And since she's sort of in this red room, I just sort of just did a really sculptural light that let her body show. And I love rendering the witch's mother body. Like, it's so great, and I never get to render that kind of stuff.
Is it because that you don't have to mess around with clothes and stuff?
I don't know. I really like the human form, and I like all the interesting shapes it takes.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like, I feel like deflated breasts have a really fascinating look that a lot of people try to never see.
Interesting.
It was really exciting to be able to get to render that and show it. Because it has all this form where there's the muscle under the, there's the pectoral muscles.
Yeah.
And then what happens is women age as the mammary tissue deflates.
Mm-hmm.
And you lose the elasticity of your skin. And it's like, it's a very evocative form
mm-hmm.
that you just never see, which I feel like is really disappointing.
Yeah. And I recall, I think we had to do with Mirka a couple of stabs at this, because it is like, it's not something she gets to draw a lot. It's not something anyone gets to draw a lot. It is, as you say, an unusual thing to find in a book.
Yeah.
And I think she absolutely nailed it.
Yeah, it's great. I'm so happy with it. So I got that sculptural light, and then I didn't want to ignore the candle, so I let the candle give like a little bit of a rim light.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually like helps create moments of interest that sort of uncanny light. And I tried to think of the lighting in this as more a cinematic, like less real light.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause she is kind of in an unreal place. And the mood is more important here than like the reality of anything. And when page 3, when he's coming in, and I'm glad she drew it like this because it gives me such a direct chance to like flatten out the light in a clean transition, you know?
Yeah, it makes, it's almost a jump scare, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's only through, I guess, that flattening of the light and then the change in the type of light it is that we get an emotional response from it.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. I want to go back for 1 second to page 2 and just make a point of, first of all, this idea of the women's language, where, you know, Izzy's first line in this book, in this issue, is "What an almighty fuck." I went back and forth a lot with the editors about whether or not they could swear, you know, in their fake suburb. And there was a lot of discussion about what we could get away with as far as like using, I don't know what they call them in comics anymore, when you just put symbols instead of swears.
Like, I don't know what it's called.
Yeah. Like a censored swear. And we had that for a while through a bunch of the books. And we wound up taking them out because it was a little... It sort of took you out of the book every time you saw it. It made you aware that you were reading a comic instead of experiencing it. But the idea that the architects are so controlling that the women even forget how to express themselves in curse words. And so when they're back in the presence of the witch mother or in any kind of magic, as we see at the end of this issue, that they're allowed to swear again, I thought was really fun. The other thing is on page 2, in the 4th panel, I had the witch mother say, "I've been trapped in hotter ovens by stupider men," which there's no right answer to this, but tell me what that means to you.
Just like witchy stuff. Like, it's sort of like a inverse Hansel and Gretel for me.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
But also like a callback to the witch trials.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. It's, they're always thrown in fires. And I think the pop culture version is Hansel and Gretel. When I gave this to the editors, Molly said, "Is that a Holocaust reference?"
Oh, God.
Right.
Whoops.
Which became so fascinating to me, like as a loaded metaphor, that it's something I tried to play with later on in like issue 7. And we'll see if it actually goes through, but conflating those things became so fascinating to me. And I don't think we pulled it off. I think it's eventually going to come out of issue 7, but I think that's kind of neat.
Okay.
All right. That's all I had to say in there.
No, that's, this is going to be a good conversation for me because sometimes like, especially as a colorist, like I don't always get the foreshadowing and the motifs and things like that. 'Cause I just get a script.
Sure.
And then I have what's in front of me and I do my best to sort of piece things together and figure out
let me ask you
what
something.
The motifs are.
Let me ask you on that. Would it be like, if you're getting a script from me, from any writer, would it be more helpful to have a like more exhaustive script? Like what would you like in a script, since you do, you're not just working off the art, you're also working off the script.
I am not a very good reader sometimes. Cause sometimes I'm working a lot and my ability to read words is not good.
Also it's exhausting. Come on. Having to read scripts.
I love reading.
Having to
I
read
do,
scripts,
but
though,
it's
so
just
boring.
Like, I just get tired and I read so much and, I don't need it to be like crazy exhaustive, but if there's motifs you want me to catch, please tell me, like, or if there's like foreshadowing you would like to build up to, it's helpful to tell your colorist because, you know, colorists plan stuff. We love to plan stuff. Mm-hmm. And so in, Escape from New York, which was one of my first jobs, Chris Sabella gave me, an outline of the 10 arcs or 12 issues, we would do. And the outline had all the different locations, that we were going to go to. And that was really helpful because then I could design palettes knowing what was coming up.
Of course.
Because I knew there was going to be a snowy Siberian place, and I knew there was going to be like a toxic Florida location.
Mm-hmm.
And because I knew those two things, I could design things earlier that would set them off.
Sure. That makes so much sense. It never even occurred to me that you wouldn't be sent all the scripts ahead of time either, that you're sort of going... Yeah, I mean, you're going issue by issue, same as the reader is a few months later.
Yeah.
That's crazy. Like, we have six done. You should have six in your hand.
Whoa. Yeah, as far as I know, nobody's doing anything.
Yeah, that's insane. I will say, like, a little to that, I had, when we started the book, I had really thoroughly broken the first two issues with Molly and Maggie, the editors, and... I knew that issue two ended with Izzy discovering the secret room and the witch mother. I did not know how issue three started. I didn't know how we got out of that.
Yeah.
So I was a little bit in the same boat that you are month to month where like they were asking me for the next script. And I was like, ugh, I know we have to get out of this. And I know that the suburb story is not going to shut down in issue three. Because we have six issues to do of this. So I do tend to like to write myself into a corner a little bit and figure out a way out of it. But these first, whatever it is, six, seven pages or five pages, I guess, were a lot of work. Like figuring out the mechanics of getting out of that. I think it was originally just three pages and that felt too quick. And then this thing on page four where Aaron is sort of gaslighting her. And saying, I don't see anything. What are you talking about? That was my wife's idea.
Yeah, I really liked that sequence a lot.
Yeah, it turned out great. It was a great idea. I think Mirka drew Izzy, especially like in the second panel on four, where she just looks just almost vacant because she's so confused. And then the way it gets darker and then lighter by the bottom of the page when he's regaining control. I think that page four is really... masterful. I think you guys all did an amazing job on it.
Yeah, that was a really fun sequence to work on. And she did. She gives me a lot to work off of, which I really appreciate.
What does that mean for you? I mean, like, what's good and what's bad from your perspective to receive from the pencils, from the inks?
That's an existential question. I don't know. Everybody has their own style.
This is about you.
My style is very responsive to everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And I really, really enjoy the puzzle aspect of coloring. And there is sometimes stuff that I find challenging to work on. But usually it's just because stuff is stuff. Let me be more precise in my words here. Usually that pages that I find most challenging are most challenging because the artist is rushed.
Mm-hmm.
And if they are rushed and not able to make clear decisions, mm-hmm. so that could be decisions about how things intersect, like if there's tangents, or about where the light is going, then it's a lot harder for me to make clear decisions.
Sure.
Some people are actually like geniuses at that. Like Dave McKeag can take a page that is completely muddled and somehow his lighting choices are so strong and so clear that it doesn't matter what the line art is doing, but it still doesn't overwhelm the line art.
Interesting. Well, is it because ultimately someone has to make a decision, right? So is it because in that sort of situation, he's steering the boat instead of like we're doing, where it really is a true collaboration?
Dave is like a really special artist where he is a very clear thinker, no matter the circumstances. So he can look at a page, clearly see what the weaknesses and strengths are, and immediately calculate the most effective solution. And that's, you know, that's why he's one of the greatest. And that's why, you know, he teaches all over the world and stuff. He's a very, very clear thinker.
Gotcha.
I am a little more of an emotional thinker. Like, I like to feel the things out. And I still like give myself a lot of structure, like I'm saying before about, you know, choosing the lighting sources and trying to direct the eye and things like that. But there's still like a lot of the stuff I do, I try to pay attention to how it makes me feel. And I hope that it makes the readers feel the same way.
That's really fascinating because that is the way that I write. And my writing partner, which I work on everything but this book with, works the other way. He's a very logical writer, and which is why I don't hang myself up on the mechanics sometimes of, I don't know, for example, how magic works. Like, I don't care. It's going to be an emotional response, or getting from A to B. It kind of doesn't matter to me. We only have 22 pages. I want to get to the parts that matter. And for me, that's the parts that make me feel something.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's very interesting. I hope Mirka is working logically, because one of us should have their head on right. we'll ask her. We'll find out.
Yeah. We got to find out if she's logical or if she's emotional.
Yeah.
It'd be really interesting to see if we're like all emotional.
I know. We should make sure to ask her that for the interview part of this. The other thing I wanted to sort of draw attention to here on page 5 before we get too far is, a couple of things. I had a lot of conversations with the editors about where to put in, because again, it didn't really matter to me and I was happy to let the reader figure it out, the scratching toe claw.
Oh yeah.
Which was to me like, yes, it is obvious that was, she magically grew herself a disgusting toe claw and that was the noise that Izzy heard. And so I never had called it out. We just sort of saw it. But at some point, Molly, I think, said, we need to call that out to make sure that that question is answered and people don't still think there are mice in the walls.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was something. The other was, or two things. One is calling magic effects instead of magic tricks or something, or spells, which I learned from a magician friend of mine. They don't call them tricks. They call them effects. And I had never seen that applied to like a supernatural thing, a world of actual magic. And I thought that would be fun just to call it a different name.
On this last panel on page 5. So like I was talking before about creating interest and focus. In this shot, there's two things that's important. Like, we need to know that the emotional control is happening. And we need to know those toenails. So you can see what I did with the green light, and that like harsh cut.
Yeah.
And then, I added a lot of detail to the toenails because like,
oh,
I said before,
interesting. I didn't realize that
the attention, the more detail calls attention to it.
Yeah. That's really neat. Was it your, choice to highlight the, bottle, the lamp coming down? Like, it seems it's sort of center panel in panel 4 here. But that's also something that could have been sort of shadowed over or didn't have to be the focus of the scene.
I know that is an important object, and that we're going to build up to how it's used for control. Mm-hmm. So I thought it was important to call out. I just took my best guess.
Yeah, no. It's funny. It's a thing I keep going back and forth on. In the scripts, to me, I felt like that was that bottle, that lamp was so shrouded. Like I tried to cover it, and every single person who read the first issue was like, "But that's a bottle. That's a genie." Like, all right, well, you're a little ahead of us then.
I don't.
that's on me. all right. So moving on to page 6 was the 9-panel grid. Is this the same color scheme? Is this the same look as the previous 9-panel grids?
Good eye. What I did was, because they're amping up the control, because they're starting to lose control, I actually shifted everything more green.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
So it's not. It is, and it's not.
Yeah.
It's moved over a little bit, but it's still pretty much the same.
That's really neat.
Same lighting. I shouldn't say pretty much the same. It's the same lighting, mm-hmm. But it's more green than it is blue now.
And I think, if I'm not mistaken, I'll have to ask Mirka, I think it's the same exact line art. We had gone back and forth about that a couple times, and I'd have to check, and I'll have to ask her, but I believe it's exactly the same.
The same, except for the last two panels.
That's right. That's what it was. Yeah. Which I really loved. Like, I love hitting the hard reset on this, which is sort of paid off in a joking way in the next page. But shifting the colors, that's really cool. You are a magician.
Yeah, I like, the two other jobs I considered I really wanted to be a detective, or I really wanted to be a magician.
Awesome.
Because, like I said, I love, I like shifting around reality. We haven't hung out in person yet. But let me tell you, I walk around with an uncanny field around me. Like,
oh, no.
Friends say that it is strange. Things get weird around me.
Fascinating.
And I love it. And I lean into it.
Well, I think, honestly, look, it's working in your art. I think that's really fascinating that you have this thing, whether consciously or not, and you can apply it to what it is you do, and it works really well. Moving on. So I talked in the past about how this 9-panel grid was always sort of the jumping off point of the book. And in this issue, where it comes on page 6, it is sort of a hard reset that Aaron has done to Izzy, so that we can, part of the reason we had this five page scene with the witch mother was for the reader to get as much information as Izzy was going to get, you know, at a certain point and halfway through this arc, it seems like we need to know a little bit more about this world. And it seemed like telling her that and then taking it away from her was the most dramatic way to do that. And then, of course, on page 7, I get to make a Groundhog Day joke.
How important are jokes for you in this book?
It's not something I consciously think about. It is part of wanting to do this book. And again, I think I talked about this on a previous commentary, is I wanted to write something for grownups. And the kind of stuff I like is not just one thing, right? It's nobody is serious all the time. And in fact, when danger is the greatest, that's when people tend to make jokes. So if we can deflate some of the horror with a joke, to me, that just makes it even more horrific. And so having Aaron sing, "I Got You, Babe," which, by the way, the DC people made us take out some of the lyrics of.
Yeah.
Which they tend to do, which I was bummed out about, because in an upcoming issue, I wanted them all to be singing a Lizzo song. And I was like, oh, they're going to make me take out those lyrics. So I have to change it totally. Anyway, so I love coming out from 6 to 7. Like, these are some we're in like green scenes here.
Yeah.
Which now that I understand, now that my brain understands instead of just emotionally understanding what that's doing, is totally fascinating to me.
Yeah, and you can see where there's like little pops of not green. Actually, mm-hmm. a lot of stuff that looks really, really red is, let me open it up and get exact colors, but it should be, a lot of stuff that looks red is either like pretty brown or mm-hmm. gray. Mm-hmm. And that's just because color is crazy. It's so incredible. I love it.
You're such a color nerd.
I am a huge color nerd. You have no idea. So these pants, you know, that look pretty warm. Mm-hmm. If they're not next to a green, they are actually a very cold, like a raw umber sort mm-hmm. of color.
Interesting.
But in all that green, it looks really red. So I mm-hmm. have to be careful with how I'm using things because it's easy for it to look too Christmassy.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think it's also neat on this page and the next one where, like, I think in my script I had said something like, you know, he's made a mess in the kitchen. And Mirka just, like, took that to heart. She went crazy.
I got this page, I was like, whoa.
I don't know how someone could make that kind of a mess in the kitchen, but...
I've seen it.
All right. That's fair. I mean, it certainly does the job, right? Sometimes I forget that a comic book is not the same medium as TV or film. Like, something that... Like, I think the way that you have colored this, the way that it's presented here, is it's almost unremarkable how extensive and ridiculous the mess is. And it almost fades into the background, which is exactly what that scene needed.
Yeah.
It's not really a question, but was that something you have to consider? Like, I guess it's more about, like, what's the focus of the scene, right? It comes back to that question.
Yeah, and, like, I think we've talked a lot about how, about the control issues and things like that in this book. And like, for me, understanding this scene, like, this, him making this mess wasn't any attempt at him making breakfast.
Right.
That's not at all what he is doing. Yeah. He is trying to control her. He's trying to, like, give her something to do so that she isn't thinking about things that she needs to think about. And so I also sort of viewed that as a normal thing for him to do.
Yeah.
So I could have made it like rainbow colored or something like that, like pulled out every spot. But that felt like, it felt too hammy and too like corny.
Yeah.
And too cartoony.
Which to me,
it just didn't hit the right notes for me.
Absolutely. When I saw the original art, I think that's what I was picturing. And I think what you did was to pull it all way back. And so it really gets to the core of it, which is, this is a control move. Which again, I think this came from a conversation with my wife who was like, a way of control is to be a baby, right? Is to say, you have to help me. I don't know what I'm doing. And I literally had him do that in the scene. And just one more note, this line at the bottom of 7, from now on you get cocktails or wine, not cocktails and wine, which to me is so condescending. It was Molly's favorite line in the whole issue. It is stolen directly from Rosemary's Baby. I'm not proud.
Oh, the best stuff comes from elsewhere. By the way,
what?
I've been meaning to tell you to see. You should see The Nightwalker.
What is? I don't even know that.
It's you know, William Castle.
Mm-hmm.
So he was a producer on Rosemary's Baby,
mm-hmm.
big horror guy. Dude, this movie is crazy. It's one of his later horror movies.
Is it one he directed or another one he produced?
He directed it.
Okay.
Which
means it's over the top.
This one actually isn't.
Really?
It's subdued. Oh, man. It's so exciting. I watched it with one of my friends, and we were just, like, blown away by it.
Oh, neat. I will look it up. And listeners, you should also.
You should also, because I have a feeling some of that stuff's going to creep into here once you see it.
Nice. That's great. Are you a horror person? Is this something you're into?
Yeah, I'm a genre person.
Okay.
Because I really like I like when things get narrowed down, and then how people sort of bend that. And I think there's always a level of unreality to any genre.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't really think of a genre as a real thing.
Yeah.
And I'm a big believer in like all the arts being lies. And it's just how you're telling the lies and why you're telling the lies. So I like genres.
That's very upsetting. all right, moving forward. So really, like, I think page 8 is just establishing that he's back in control. She doesn't remember anything. I will say this panel 5, where she is serving him, that panel is a redraw for Mirka. It was originally from the opposite angle, where he was in the foreground. And it was important to me that we see his eyes in this panel, asking, "You don't remember what your dream was about," because he's sort of testing her there, right? He's pushing her a little bit. And I think she once she turned it around, I think she absolutely got that.
Yeah.
Then we're outside here on page 9, and let's talk about the fire.
Yeah, let's.
I've said a few times that I think I didn't realize how important the fire surrounding the town was until I saw your colors on it in issue 1. Can you talk about addressing the fire and sort of the ongoing job of coloring that?
Yeah, because that's kind of a puzzle. I'm going to pull up issue 1 real fast so that I can remember what I did. And I remember on issue 3 that I did have to talk to Molly about like what the fire is linked to and how it's working and like what it means.
Interesting.
Because that sort of pushes around how things work.
Yeah, that's true. So you knew stuff in this issue. So pages 9 and 10, and then a little later on, we'll see the fire again when they go approach it, that the reader won't find out until much later.
Yeah, maybe knowing is too rich a word, but closely guessed some things.
Sure.
But yeah, so like in issue 1, fire shows up a couple different times, but it doesn't have the same meaning that it develops later.
Yeah.
So I didn't have as strong of a specific vocabulary for it.
Mm-hmm. But I do like how you really made it omnipresent. And it made me aware that they are constantly surrounded by this thing. And for me, it was just a device for them to not be able to leave town. But the idea that it was this always present thing in their lives, this always present danger that was controlling them, didn't become clear to me until I saw, I think, a lot of issue 1, where it was, you know, seeing the color of the sky and seeing the smoke in the background really hit that home for me.
For me, what happened was like, I don't like being controlled.
Really?
Yeah, shocking revelation. And like the idea that they were trapped in there by this fire was like grating to me, and I wanted to convey that gratingness constantly.
Mm-hmm.
Because earlier in the issue, the fire like doesn't matter to them, you know, like you see fire in a lot of sequences to them and it doesn't have any effect on them.
Right. It's a matter of
fact.
So
like, yeah. And so for this fire to be limiting them and trapping them is like meaningful. But I didn't know if there was a plan for it or anything. So I just like did emotional stuff on it.
It makes sense.
So I talked to Molly, our editor, when we got to the fire here, because if it was linked to anybody's magic, it was important that link stay strong. And for me not to like have to do crazy things to walk it back later.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So I'm not fully clear on how the fire links up to everything. So I'm just sort of using it in that emotional way. And I got to do sort of grosser colors.
How so?
Everything is just kind of like gray and olive and like 70s colors,
yeah.
You know, that people consider repulsive. So I really leaned into sort of 70s colors there.
Oh, funny. That's interesting. And yeah, I mean, I guess you see that in the car.
Yeah. The light is, it's a little, I don't think I've still fully worked it out, but like, I want the light on the fire to be like a more real light because I do know it is linked to some kind of magic. But I don't know which magic.
Should I tell you right now and we can cut this out?
No, you can tell me later.
Okay.
You should tell me though. It's very important.
I should tell you. I'm surprised Molly didn't because she knows because she's.
She might have, and I was just on deadline and I forgot.
Sure, sure. All right.
Sometimes that happens.
I'll email you later. And I'll send you the rest of the scripts too.
Yes.
And then we get this 2-page spread, which now this conversation has been so clarifying for me that to see the green bunker. That this is the source of control makes so much sense.
Yeah. What did you think before you knew what the green was doing?
In this sequence, in this little scene, it just made sense as a natural fit. Like, you know, if you weren't going to make the obvious sort of metallic choice to do something green, just kind of made sense to me. And I guess it is the emotional sense that you've built through 3 issues at this point that of course it would be green. I mean, even looking now, and this I didn't clock this earlier, that like the architects who are here in the bunker, half of them are wearing green shirts too.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're good at it.
Yeah. I think maybe even the ones that look blue are actually a green, but they just look blue because that's real green
because there's so much green
because everything's so green that anything that's like it looks like a lot of colors, but it's really all just greens.
And it's interesting too though to see, so this is a 2-page spread and it's 3 levels, which is pretty much how I described it in my, I think in my script I had a lot more dialogue and I'm glad we wound up cutting a lot of that out, but the contrast between the underground and how green that is and then the overground, which still has a lot of green, feels like it doesn't because it's contrasted with the intense green of the other 2 levels.
Yeah, and I think I also just pushed that a little bit. Let me double check here. I might have pushed that a little bit more. Yeah, yellow. Because that is like more, that does have a lot of greens in it, but I push it just a little bit more yellow.
Mm-hmm.
To help the other green look more green.
Oh, interesting. That's really neat. It's a good trick. And it totally works. I mean, when these bottom 2 levels feel not just like we're in another world, but somehow it feels like we're in the real world after spending so much time in that fabricated place.
Oh, good. I'm glad. Cause this one, everything's kind of small and reflective. It was a little bit harder to put in more rendering without it looking overworked.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm happy to hear that it still looks real.
it feels more real than previously. It's really interesting. I had a lot more jokes on these 2 pages that I wound up taking out, which I'm glad, but I love like this last line, they're just talking about gardening or some shit, is both to set up you know, the garden. Like I had to think a lot about what these women do all day because they're not allowed to do anything. And they're not allowed to do anything that could get them hurt or make them bleed. And it became a real struggle, but I love how dismissive the guys are. They think they've got this locked down.
Yeah.
And so this felt like getting to see them being themselves, not putting on the act of being husbands was a chance to really show that. Then these next 2 pages, 12 and 13, first of all, there's so many word balloons on this. I hate it so much.
I haven't haven't looked at the finished one. Oh, wait. I haven't seen the printed PDF, or I haven't seen the PDF with the lettering on it.
Well, get
into
it.
Because
there's too many words. But there was
a lot. Who's to blame for that?
Ugh, it's gross. Well, look, the art is so good. I hate to cover it up, but also I don't know how to tell a story without dialogue.
It's a challenge. I think it's one of those challenges of comics where, like, you do need words. You need people to say stuff on the panel, unless this is a personal viewpoint of mine. Mm-hmm. If you want people to stay on a panel, I think that, like, not having words on it encourages them to look at the art.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one way to, like, sort of grind your readers to a halt. But if you need to pace it faster, people need to be kind of quippy.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I mean, it is all about this. All of comics making, right, is about controlling the pace of the story, is controlling the pace of reading. And so I think while there is so much dialogue on these two pages, I do think it works, and hopefully it flies by, where they're sort of comparing all the drugs that they're on, and they're all on birth control, which obviously has a lot more, is loaded with meaning, but it's also a means of controlling so much about the women.
I have a question.
I'll allow it.
Okay. They're on birth control.
Mm-hmm.
Are they on that one that prevents periods?
Yes, they are.
Okay.
They are on,
just to double check.
They're on a fictional version of that one, because even that one, many women can get their periods while on it, even if it's just like at once every 3 months or something like that. So we, after doing the research, like, all right, they are just on a fictional thing that the architects developed that keeps them from having their periods at all. And that just makes life a little bit easier, because it was too difficult a question.
I do think about that sometimes when I'm coloring. I'm like, biological factors.
Right, exactly. It was when I first pitched the book, it wasn't even something I thought about. I was like, well, because the blood magic stuff didn't come till I was scripting issue one. I was like, well, if it's about blood, then we have to have an answer for that. And this seemed like the one that made the most sense. And then I sort of found a way to pay it off in issue four, which I was glad about. I also really, Molly loves the cheese puffs on page 13, to me, I don't know. It just felt so funny to me that these guys are just at their job and they're just, you know, yutzes who are like, I don't know, we're just eating cheese puffs. And I think there were actually extra panels that were specifically about who is holding the bag of cheese puffs, which I'm glad we took out.
I like they're just trading them back and forth. It's that little thing, like, does a really good job of illustrating the camaraderie.
Yeah, I mean, we really want to draw teams, right? We really want to say that these guys, even though they may disagree, whatever it is, they are in this together, and they do feel like they are in control. And then it's by design that Bradley says, "I'm taking these cheese puffs," because he is a little more seniority. He is a little more in control than, or he's a little more of a general or whatever than these other guys are. You know, if Aaron's at the top, then Bradley's there with him or right below him. And it's a suggested hierarchy. It's not something that we really explore until a little bit later. But, you know, I wanted to make clear that they're not all equal, but they do all believe the same thing.
Yeah.
All right, let's get through this. So they get in their cars, they're going out to the fires. We have these pieces in the cars, which I like. You know, I didn't want to set this anywhere in time. And I think that Mirka did a good job of creating cars that are sort of timeless. And then I love the sort of, as you said, like the 70s palette that you apply to it. Makes it feel not like the 50s, which it could feel like, and certainly not contemporary either.
Yeah, I think Mirka is doing a great job sort of choosing clothes that aren't rooted in too specific of a time.
Mm-hmm.
And the haircuts, everything is a little outside of time, which
yeah.
is great.
Yeah, 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 yeah. And then, of course, like, there's just just layering in the irony of, like, Mabel saying, "You're good men." And I'm sure everyone helped and all that. And then we get to this bit with the fire, I do, like, Aaron continues to call them girls, which is so diminishing. This fire thing, I wish I could remember where it came from. I think it came out of conversations with Molly and Maggie, because we needed something active to happen in this issue.
You need things to happen in your comics.
Yeah. If it were up to me, they'd just be like hanging out, talking all day, just for 20 pages and then 2 pages of action. But yeah, I like where this turned out. And it came, I think it came out of the conversation of like, if the women feel like they are straying, if they're starting to question anything, a way of keeping them in control is to, one, for Mabel to have to, for lack of a better word, mother her husband, right? She has to take care of this person. That becomes her entire reason for being. And then for the others, it's just a way of throwing them off their guard, right? It's making them depend more on the men.
Yeah. How are you finding, like, 'cause you've mentioned, in your other, what are these called? Accompanying tracks for the mm-hmm. comics. You've mentioned that you do really like it to be sort of an emotional core, and you really want to focus on the relationships. So how are you finding, like, fitting in action things?
That's been the trick, right? Is, like, how can action speak to where the character's at and where her relationship is at? Like, a byproduct of this scene of Bradley getting caught in the fire is it brings Izzy and Nadia together in the next scene on page 18. They're the two who go to visit Mabel and Domina. So some of it is that, is like, how does having action, which yes, moves the plot, but how does it also move the relationships? How does it move the character from one place to another? Like, I knew by issue 6, I wanted Mabel at rock bottom, because I know where I want her to go in the second arc. And to get her there, she has to be at rock bottom by the end of the first arc. And so again, her husband being caught in this fire will help us get her there. And Domina and her relationship is in response to that, right? If Mabel's going to be at rock bottom and not actually help Bradley because she can't bear to, Mabel's the one who's sort of most bought into the lie they've been told, then Domina's going to pick up the slack. And how does that affect her relationship with this person who she thinks is her father? Like, it all becomes deliciously complicated and soap opera-y for me, which I really like.
Yes. When you're thinking of action, do you think of the consequence that needs to happen for the action and then sort of building backwards from there?
Yeah, pretty much. When I sit down to script, I think about the first couple pages and the last couple pages. And then it's a question of what needs to happen in this issue to get me there. And then, in this instance, the last page I already knew. So it was building backwards from that. But then this other piece, 18, 19, I guess just 18 and 19, I knew we had, you know, I wanted these relationships to move in this direction. So what would help us get there? And I think it really was a conversation with the editors who said, we want to know more about the fire. We want to know, like, what's the women's relationship to that? Are they bummed that they can't leave? And that's where the idea of Nadia showing up in the van saying, girls, we're going on a road trip, and then the men having to deal with that. So it's sort of like one thing sort of started to inform the other, and it all started to work backwards in that way. For this issue, certainly. Other issues may have been built a little differently. This was a particularly tough issue because we couldn't push things too far along as far as what the coven knows. But we had to move things along emotionally. We had to move things along in the relationships. We knew the reveal of the men in their bunker, keeping an eye on them and controlling them in ways that, you know, were less obvious, were sort of secret, was going to have to come out in this issue too. So this issue had to do a lot of work while also not moving the ball too much forward.
Yeah.
We did a few drafts of this one. This really was a tough one. I thought the stuff in Mabel's house was, again, really effective, really evocative. I loved how Mirka drew, I'm on 18, panel 2. I loved how she drew her grabbing the bottle of wine.
Yeah.
To me, that is
kind of action is really tough to convey in a comic, since it's, you know.
Yeah. Pages. But it's so perfect, and it lands as a joke. And it also lands in a character way, right? I think that's so good. And then the bottom three panels here of Mabel drinking, what I sent to Mirka on this, and you may have seen this in the script too, although we may have sent it separately, was the scene in Jaws when Roy Scheider is having dinner and what's his name?
That was the script,
Hooper comes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was in the script. And Hooper comes to the house and wants to talk to him about the shark, and he just keeps filling up his wine glass. I love that scene. And I think she really, like, she drew it in this, and it's amazing. Like, you get what Mabel's going through here.
Yeah, the acting on that sequence is just so good.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, I wanted it to be so sad, and it's even sadder than I thought it would be. Mirka's such a happy person that I wasn't sure how she would pull it off. But she, like you say, it's absolutely the acting. She gets it. She totally gets it. I wanted to ask you about the 19, the top two panels here, and the purple.
Oh, yeah. So I sort of figured that their control is going to not do so good. I do tend to find that, like, when people are pushed to a certain point, they are much harder to control. And so I needed this to be just like a little less about their control, mm-hmm. a little darker, a little more diverse in the emotions. Mm-hmm. So I started reintroducing colors like purple.
Oh, that's neat. Yeah. I mean, what it reads to me, which is absolutely what I was going for as well, is it's a true emotion coming out, rather than the controlled emotion, or rather than being told what they need to feel in this moment. It's what she's actually feeling in this moment. And it really sells. I love how that looks.
Glad it's working. You can see like the colors sort of starting to infect other people.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, for sure. And then we'll just wrap up here. This final sequence, these last three pages, there was some sort of Desperate Housewives, or, you know, that sort of suburban soap opera going on these, where which I really love. And I wish we actually had room to do more of, where Becky is like, what's going on with these two? And they're just like, it is weird over there. Like, yeah. I want to live in that world a little more.
Yeah.
And then is there a different green going on in these gardening scenes than there has been previously in this issue?
It's like, I try to do more like, this green is the green that they're voluntarily engaging in, you know?
Yeah.
So it's not like, I don't think it's that different, but it's like a little more saturated. It just feels fresher. Rather than the sort of stifling green I was using in other areas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it that's absolutely true. I mean, it feels brighter. It feels like a happier place instead of, like you say, the controlled green that you'd used elsewhere. That's really neat.
and I always do roses yellow.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
So out in Oregon, in Portland, we have this rose garden.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like all the different types of roses that are conceivable. So they have this test garden. And my favorite colors of roses are yellow and white and purple. Purple and white roses tend not to work so well. So mm-hmm. I just do yellow roses.
That's great. It looks great. And it's nice. Like, it's both a compliment to and the unexpected thing to find here in this garden. It's cool.
Yeah.
This sequence with the cat, I, to be honest, I don't know that it totally plays. It was a complicated physical sequence that we sort of didn't have room for, But the idea is basically that there are two cats here, and one is distracting the other so that Becky turns around and chops the head off of one of them. I can talk about this more in the next issue because there was stuff that got cut out that sort of explained some of this. I'm not for killing cats. I want to be on the record for that. But there's obviously stuff going on here that the women need blood for their magic, and that is being orchestrated now by these cats so that Becky kills one of them and draws blood and therefore flies at the end against her control.
How much agency do these cats have? I was wondering about that.
That's the thing I can talk about next issue.
Okay.
Because there's a... Oh, no, you know what? It wasn't this issue. This issue originally started with a three-page sequence of the cats all having a conversation.
Oh, really?
Because I think this is already established that Domina's special power is talking to cats.
Yeah.
So we're sort of... It'll come out next issue, but the cats have a bit of agency. The cats have personalities. There was a political struggle among the cats. There was a nobility struggle among the cats about who would be the one to sacrifice herself. There's a lot going on with these cats that ultimately Molly was like, nobody cares about those cats as much as you do.
I do.
I thought it was a really fun sequence and it was fun to write, but I think the editors ultimately were really right that we have to be with our main character. Like, there's so many characters already to keep track of that if we have to start tracking cats as well, it might get complicated.
It's going to be a lot.
But yes, so the cats do have agency. I think that's fair to say here, and that this distraction and then Becky turning around with the shears and killing one of the cats is all by design. Initially, this was going to happen to Nadia in her kitchen. And it was sort of set up in the second issue where the cat was running across the table. We were going to revisit that. But a couple of things happened. One was I sort of fell in love with Becky in the second issue and I love writing her. And I felt like it would be way more fun if it were her. I also realized she's the one who, once these powers are revealed to her, is going to embrace them more than anyone else. And that's what I needed to start moving the story forward. So it fell to Becky to have to accidentally murder a cat and then fly. And then this last page, we've rewritten this last line a few times. I'm still not sure it works, so I apologize to the reader. But I think it's funny. I don't know. Initially, she was saying...
What's the last line? I don't remember.
The last line now is, this is not the way I saw this day going. Which is fine. Originally, I had her going something like, what the almighty fuck, which is also fine. Which is sort of an echo of the first line of this issue. I'm a little obsessed with bookends in that way. Like, I love those callbacks and those echoes of dialogue, of images, of stuff like that, which, if it hasn't been apparent already, it should be by now. The thing that is insane to me is the way that Mirka has drawn this dead cat.
I know, it's so funny.
It's so upsetting. I don't know. Like, I don't know what to make of it. I don't think it's the right thing, to be honest, but I really? Kind of love it. Yeah.
No, it's great.
It feels a little cartoony to me, but it really is great. Like, it's so sick.
I like leaning into the cartooniness in like this kind of violence, just because it gives you a level of distance.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Whereas if it were like really realistic, I think people would just find it straight up upsetting.
I think that's really fair. And there's enough in this book, especially in these first three issues, that's upsetting already emotionally to have the sort of violence to be a little over the top, be a little cartoony. Yes, you're right. Does give it a little distance. I love how bright the blood is on this.
Yeah. I just used her. She drew in all that blood and she did like a process red.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Sometimes we get that from Mirka.
Yeah. And so on the Witch Mother, I changed her process red. Mm-hmm. But on this, I left it just because I liked how cartoony it looked.
Yeah, I think it really works. And then the big yellow background too. Like, can you tell me about that choice?
Yeah, let me open up the file because I think I did a few things on this. It...
Because there's texture here too. Was that from you?
We both added texture. She sent me, so there's some of it that's hers, the like scratchy stuff is hers. And that is grayscale in the line art. Oh yeah. I see what I did. Oh my God. Oh wow. Yeah. Yeah, I had to try a few things on this one too, to get it to work. So she sent it with this texture, and the texture was to give it focus to Becky. But it didn't quite work in my opinion in gray. So I color held that to a red and then amped it up with, some value changes around Becky and that, putting those dark, dark shadows around Becky that are darker than thinner in the cat. And that bright light behind her so that you get that high contrast that make sure your eye is up there and not on the cat.
Yeah.
Because that green red contrast does draw the eye more.
Yeah, that's true.
So I had to even out the value contrast so that you look up there. And then I did all these different attempts with, levels and filters and, shifting around the palette so that I could get things, where I wanted them. I did this one crazy thing on here. Oh, yeah. So there's something called a gradient map in Photoshop. And what it does is it processes each value as a color. And because of the relationships I was looking for in this, where I wanted the shadows to be like really red, I cast a sort of brown red shadow. But that wasn't quite enough, especially because, especially because on the cat, it was like, the way light reflects off of white is different than it reflects off of other things. Like the shadows are a little lighter. So I put a gradient map, on the shadows to sort of make everything richer. It's probably hard to tell just looking at it, but yeah, there was a lot of tricks in this one.
It's so interesting. And this was, I know, a tough page for both of you. I mean, you did a lot of work on it, and Mirka actually redrew Becky a number of times, in different poses till we could sort of find the right one that had the right feeling of like confusion and excitement and just, and horror, like all of, there's so much going on in this one splash page. And I think you two really pulled it off. I'm so impressed by it. And it's a great cliffhanger, I think, for the next issue.
Yeah, it's a good cliffhanger. How are you thinking about, like I was saying before about it all being still images, how are you thinking about distilling what you want to say down into one moment?
That's the part that's sort of come easiest. It's the part I like best. And I've talked a little bit about this before, but I was lucky enough to be friends with Len Wein before he died for a number of years. And Len, of course, created Wolverine and Swamp Thing and like a million characters and was writing comics for 50 years, 60 years. And when I first started in comics, Len gave me great advice, which was writing comics is like looking at a film strip and picking out the one image that best conveys the story.
Yeah.
I think of that every single time and, you know, figuring out what that one image, which is why like the last couple pages of this issue where I have to convey a continuous action is so hard for me. Cause I like the moments. I like, you know, the small visual piece that tells you a bigger story rather than a series of small pieces, which I guess is ultimately what comics is. I don't know. So I don't know if that answers the question, but yeah, it's finding the physical thing first and then trying to use as few words as possible, though it doesn't always seem it. I know with this book,
your scripts are actually a lot shorter than some scripts I get.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I mean, it's comes from taste as a reader, too, right? Like, I don't like to open a book and see a whole ton of word balloons. it's about ease of reading. You know, it's about, like we talked about, like it's about pacing. And, you know, there are writers who are so expert at that. Like I looked at so much of Brian K. Vaughan's stuff before starting this book, because I think he's so good at that. Anyway, that's it. That's all I got. Thank you for taking us.
What? You said you're reading Brian K. Vaughan. What else are you reading?
Right now, I read everything. I think Tom King is the best we have, the best Batman I've ever read. I read it as soon as it comes out. The other things I read as soon as they come out are Giant Days. Are you reading Giant Days?
Yeah.
I love it so much. I can't believe he's done over 50 issues, and like, it's as riveting as an action movie, and it's just these goofy friends hanging out. I really love that book.
I got to meet half the team when I was in, I didn't meet Whitney because she's in LA, I think. I met the writer when I was at Thought Bubble.
Oh yeah. Yeah. John Allison is so unassuming. Right. Yeah. I think I was on a panel with him a few years ago and I was like raving at him about this book and thank you. Thanks very much. Glad you like it.
Well, he lit up when I started talking to him about how I like Whitney's coloring, and then he said a lot.
Oh, that's awesome. That's really nice to hear. Well, of course, it's so much easier for us to compliment other people.
Yeah, it really is.
What are you reading? What shouldn't I miss? What am I not reading that I should be?
Oh man, I don't know. I'm kind of a mess with that stuff. Like I said, I don't have a ton of time to read, but I'll show you actually one thing you might be interested in. Let me see if I can find this book. I got this book in France that is very, very interesting. I don't read French, so I have no idea what it says. But it's like really beautiful, and it's about this guy who plucks a little baby out of the ground and tries to raise it. And then it doesn't go great.
I don't know this at all. We'll have to.
I'll have to find it and send it to you.
That's cool.
Which reminds me, have you seen Little Otek?
No, I keep hearing great things though.
Oh, I love it. That's one of my favorites.
All right.
If you enjoy reading things, I highly recommend Delicious in Dungeon.
I don't know that.
It's a manga. And it's in black and white, but the drawing is so sweet and the human interaction is really sweet. And the overall arc is incredible.
Like nice.
The scale of things is really interesting because it seems really small and really huge at the same time.
That is the best stuff. That's great. Oh, good. I'll look for it. Does it offend you when something's in black and white?
No, absolutely not. I would prefer black and white over poorly done color.
That is fair. Well, you are killing it. Oh, and you have a new book out, which we should tell people about.
Oh, Grumble.
Yeah, which is really fun.
Oh, I'm glad to hear it. I really like that one. Everybody is a goofball on that book, and so it's really, really fun to work on.
And it's a goofy book, but it's also like there are stakes. The stuff lands. I really liked that first issue.
Yeah, it's really a blast to work on. And things get wilder and wilder. So it's really fun.
Nice. Good. And people should check it out. Who's the publisher again?
That's Albatross. So that's Eric Powell's imprint.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Eric Powell is amazing to work with. He pulls really hard for all the team, and he takes care of all of us, and I love him.
Thanks for taking all of this time to chat. I really found this fascinating. There was so much I didn't know or understand. There's so much I still don't understand, but I feel like I'm looking at this book with new eyes. So thank you so much.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for chatting.
Of course. Let's talk again soon.
Forever Dog.
This has been a Forever Dog production. Executive produced by Brett Boehm, Joe Cilio, and Alex Ramsey. For more original podcasts, please visit foreverdogpodcasts.com and subscribe to our shows on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Keep up with the latest Forever Dog news by following us on Twitter and Instagram @ForeverDogTeam and liking our page on Facebook.